Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 662, April 2023.
Hello everyone and welcome back to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and before we start the show, I just want to thank today's sponsor, Omni Consumer Products. You guys know OCP. They provide support and management services in markets traditionally regarded as non-profit, like hospitals, prisons, and space exploration. But OCP says good business is where you find it.
And remember, they care.
They do care a lot. Now, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to praise the one, the only, because as everyone knows, there are no sequels, spin-offs, or remakes of this movie whatsoever, RoboCop from 1987, written by Edward Neumeier and Michael Miner, directed by Paul Verhoeven, and starring Peter Weller and Nancy Allen. And joining me to override our prime directives today are Erica Ensign.
Dead or Alive, you're podcasting with me.
Moises Chuyan.
Nerds leave.
Oh, very good. And you just heard him there earlier, Steve Lutz.
I'm very much looking forward to talking about this movie because I like it.
Hey, there you go. There you go. I am amazed, absolutely amazed, that we hadn't already done this movie on The Incomparable. I just assumed that we had, and I'd forgotten about the episode, and then I don't know why, but it came to me to look it up, and I sure enough, I checked, and I was like, oh, we've never done it.
That presumably means that somebody doesn't hold it in extremely high esteem.
Well, possibly, yeah, but I don't know, it's just kind of, for me, it's such a part of the cultural landscape that, I don't know, it baffled me a little. But, I mean, let's kind of get into that. Let's have it's going to be difficult to talk about this movie without spoiling it, and obviously, it's so old. We've got to assume most people listening have already seen it, but for the sake of anybody who hasn't, let's do a pre-spoiler round of kind of opening statements and talk about how we first saw the movie and our relation to it and that relationship to it and that sort of thing. So Erica, let's start with you. Where did you first see it?
I'm pretty sure I watched this in college or in university for school. It was one of my many film classes, and I don't even remember which class or why it was that we were watching it. I suspect it probably had something to do with the framing of the having all the commercials and all that kind of corporate media stuff. And I probably had to write a paper on it that I have thankfully blocked out since then. But being a science fiction fan, I enjoyed the movie for many other reasons than just the ads and stuff, although that kind of stuff was cool. And I think I had already known of the movie quite a bit before that, even though I hadn't seen it until I was in college in the 90s, because, as you said, it was just sort of part of the cultural landscape, especially with the movie fans and science fiction fans. So I had already heard people quoting the, you know, I'd buy that for a dollar. And for some reason, like, it seems like every household has their own sort of movie quotes that they return to a lot. And Clarence Bodiger, "You are under arrest," was just a line that I have heard a billion times. And I don't know why of all the lines in this movie.
Wow.
But
yeah,
it was just one of those things. Right?
It's an odd line to quote
right?
from this movie.
I have odd friends. Let's just put it that way. So yeah, I kind of just knew a lot about it and then rewatched it a bunch of times because it was fascinating and entertaining and interesting. So I don't know how often I've seen it, but I honestly, when you put up a poll to be on the podcast for this, I was like, man, I just watched this movie like 3 months ago because Steven hadn't seen it. And I showed it to him for the first time. And I was like, well, I don't mind watching it again that quickly to be on a podcast and talk about it again. So here I am. Yeah. If you have not seen this yet, it is still worth watching. It holds up in a lot of ways. It's
in some ways uncomfortably so.
Yeah, and in some ways it's interesting watching a movie that is about the police force in which the police are the heroes. it's a little uncomfortable in this day and age. And I think it was for a lot of people in that day and age as well, but I didn't know because I was a clueless white privileged college student. But yeah, so it is still a fascinating thing. And as Moises said, there are a lot of ways where it seemed so prescient that it's uncomfortable how right it got some things. So yeah, definitely worth checking out.
It really is. I'm amazed that Stephen hadn't seen it as well. That's crazy.
Don't be surprised. His record for viewing things is like, if it's common, probably not. If it's super weird and rare and British, yeah, he probably saw it.
That's fair. Moises, what about you?
I alluded to it in the pre-show, but this movie was shot in Dallas, where I grew up when I was very young. And I also saw it when I was far too young, like when I saw the Police Academy movies and various other things. In early elementary school, I don't know that a lot of the social things completely landed for me, but growing up in the household that I did, where, you know, talk of fascism and that sort of thing was, a big part of my upbringing as the son of a Cuban refugee. I think a lot of its themes landed for me in different ways than did other kids who also saw it too young, because RoboCop was one of those movies of the 80s and early 90s, thanks to videotape. Of that time when people were discovering things, that kids were discovering it earlier than they should, because seeing edgy, violent movies, I mean, that was cool. That was a thing that you mm-hmm. were, you know, forbidden from. And so that's absolutely what you would go over to the kid whose house in the neighborhood where their parents were absent and didn't care what you were watching or what you were doing. And you would watch, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street movies or RoboCop.
God bless the latchkey kids.
Yeah. Right. Right. So
they provided such an education for the rest of us.
Watching it earlier, some of the very clearly satirical and intended to be satirical stuff landed for me, and I got it. And my relationship with the movie has only grown over time. And I'm sure we'll get into this more. I think what is most interesting about the movie is the social constructs around it, where it is an alternate reality that the absolute wrong people adopted the absolute wrong things of as trying to forward them as actual reality, and justification for the kind of assumed stances people have on the roving rape gangs just, you know, wandering the streets, that we need to militarize our police to gun down. Otherwise, those horrible, totally real roving rape gangs of punks are going to wreak havoc on everything. The other aspect of this that isn't spoilery is, having grown up in Dallas, it's hilarious seeing them go to OCP headquarters for the first time. And that's literally Dallas Police Headquarters, or at least the old Dallas Police Headquarters building. The building they use for the Detroit PD precinct is like a former industrial garment factory that got converted into a hotel that I've stayed in now. In the first big chase between the van and the patrol car, if you have any familiarity with the Dallas skyline, you can very clearly see Reunion Tower, the tower with a ball on top that rotates. Mm-hmm. You can see that in the background. They pass Texas Instruments buildings. They don't do a lot to hide the fact that it's Texas in various shots, where they couldn't have really easily done anything other than paint a giant sign or something.
I mean, why bother? Because clearly in the future, Detroit is going to mimic Dallas in its architecture. Mm-hmm. So there we have it.
It'll be incredibly brutalist. Yep. It'll look like a bombed out hellscape. And to quote the opening of Zombieland, which mentions the actual hometown of mine, a suburb of Dallas, Garland. In Zombieland, Jesse Eisenberg's voiceover says, "It may look like a post-apocalyptic hellscape, but that's just Garland, Texas." Dallas in the late 1980s does a great job of looking like a near future crime-ridden, broken-down, busted thing that looks like it really could use some fascism to clean things up.
I wonder how much of that is just Verhoeven going, it's America, they all look the same.
Yeah, you know, I think location wise, the filming incentives were there, and they could get the kinds of locations they needed, and they could spend the money they needed to on the go motion, stop motion stuff and effects stuff and the suits and the makeup and all that. And that's just where it was cheap to film.
Yeah, no, it's the reality of filming. Yeah. Steve, what about you? Where did you first see it?
You know what? I actually don't recall exactly when I saw RoboCop, but I definitely came at it from kind of an odd direction. I remember in 1987, when I was in my mid-teens and was very much in the target audience for this movie, thinking that it sounded kind of dumb. I don't think the title did it any great shakes, because RoboCop just sounds kind of silly, and it sounded like your standard late 80s action movie. And I'd seen plenty of those, and then the name just sounded kind of goofy. And I was, I'll miss it. Maybe I'll catch it on video later. And then somehow I ended up seeing RoboCop 2, which I guarantee you it exists because I rewatched it last night. I ended up seeing that in the theater. I don't know. I must have been roped into it by
somebody.
Wait,
so you saw that before you'd seen RoboCop 1?
Yes, I did.
Wow. Wow.
And I remember seeing it, and I was like, you know what? That was a very dumb 80s action movie. I think it's 1990, but close enough. But it was enjoyable enough. I had fun. I actually liked the brutalism of it. And a couple years later, probably, I finally caught RoboCop on video. And there was enough, I guess, distance between that and my viewing of RoboCop 2 that I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty good too. It seems a little different, but that was enjoyable as well. In retrospect, I hadn't seen RoboCop until a couple nights ago for probably 25 years, and I think I'd seen RoboCop 2 since it came out. So I had it in mind that, you know what, I like RoboCop a lot, and I also think RoboCop 2 is pretty good, and it probably has a unfairly bad reputation. So just for the heck of it, I rewatched 2 last night, and oh no. It's not good.
No, it's not. It's not. Number 2 is not unjustly maligned.
No, I mean, it has its moments, but the tone is so completely different from what Verhoeven was going for, and it's all over the place. It's a mess. But we're not here to talk about RoboCop 2. Point being, though, that I now recognize that RoboCop is a masterpiece, and 2 is not so great. So
welcome, Steve. Welcome.
Certainly an odd way to get there, but I got there.
But that's funny what you say about the name, because by all accounts, Hollywood's reaction in general to the script was pretty much the same. The moment, including Paul Verhoeven at first, the moment anybody heard the title, they went, oh, that sounds dumb. That sounds like some silly kids B sci-fi movie. I'm not interested in that. And yet it never changed, because what's his name? Ed Neumeier said, I saw him say in an interview, it's on a special feature on the special edition DVD, I think. He says, like, everybody wanted to change it, but nobody could come up with a better title, because it literally tells you what the movie is.
Sure.
You can't beat a title that tells you what the movie is, you know?
I'm glad they kept it, because the goofiness kind of goes along with the tones in the movie.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
So I was a mid-teen, same as you, when this came out. I was 14 going on 15 when it was released in the US. I'm not sure about the UK, because back then we often got movies, you know, several months after they were released in the US. What I do remember is that everyone I know saw it and loved it. It was an 18 certificate over here, which means this may have been the first movie that I snuck into underage. I'm not actually sure if it was the first, but I certainly did. I remember I did see it in the theater, no question.
So you're going to have to explain the 18 certificate to those of us on this side of the pond.
I mean, that literally just means you have to be 18 to see it. Simple as that.
Can you go with a guardian or parent?
Nope.
Okay.
We don't have that.
So that is slightly different than the R rating.
We don't have those ridiculous things where you can't see this unless you're an adult. Oh, unless you are a child who's got an adult with you, that which is absurd. No, 18 just means you have to be 18. And I wasn't.
Well, I think it bears mentioning in this same breath that I think the movie that you saw, I used to know the rating and censorship history of the movie better than I do now, but did the UK get the uncensored director's cut that in the US was rated NC-17?
I was going to get to that. Yeah. Yeah. We got the, what is now known as the director's cut, but at the time was just the theatrical edition for the UK, because the British censor board, and this is remarkable because normally it's the other way around, but the British censor board actually watched it and got the context and said, oh, no, actually, it's pretty clear in context that this is cartoonish and this is meant to be funny and satirical. And therefore, you know, we'll let it go through without any cuts. Whereas the American censor board, or ratings board, I should say, had completely the opposite reaction. And yes, the version that you guys got over there for the theatrical is actually, I mean, it's not markedly different, but I was quite shocked when I saw the changes, when I saw what had been cut, because, and Verhoeven's talked about this in interviews, it kind of lessens the comedy and the satire a bit, because it just makes a lot of the violent scenes feel more like regular violent scenes in movies. Whereas in the director's cut, and the version we saw here in the UK, they are so over the top and so drawn out that you can't help but go, oh, okay, this is obviously a parody. This is obviously satirical and kind of taking the mickey. I find that whole thing quite fascinating that we got the more violent version. It may be the only movie where that's ever happened.
And now I'm really curious, because I don't think I've ever seen the director's cut. I just watched whatever they had on Amazon Prime, and I assume it was the theatrical release. So
If it had a rating,
then you saw the U.S. theatrical cut. If it was unrated, then that was the director's cut. It's difficult to know. The differences, honestly, I mean, for me, in overanalyzing them, it's something that can change the meaning of the movie. But for me, it more than anything, it lessens how over the top it is. But that isn't to say that the violence isn't still over the top, even with the cuts. In the long history of U.S. censorship by the MPAA, I'm sorry, ratings advice, because we don't censor things in the United States. Yeah. We make advice that people have to conform to if they want their movie released. Even with those cuts, it doesn't change the underlying meaning of the movie. But to the point brought up by Verhoeven and Neumeier and everybody associated with the movie and dozens of home video releases that we've all bought seven of, it doesn't fundamentally change the severity of what's going on. It just screws with the precise. It's a re-edit from the worst kind of studio interference imaginable, which isn't just somebody in a corner office. It's somebody in a corner office who doesn't even work for said studio and doesn't care about the outcome of the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They weren't made, you know, none of these cuts were made for artistic reasons. It was purely just to lessen the perception of the violence. I say, I find them a bit strange. Also because one of them, this is kind of semi-spoiler territory, but one of the cuts actually denies us seeing an incredible model, an amazing prosthetic, which it's only really within the sort of modern age where you can freeze frame and, you know, step by step go through a frame that you might even realize is a prosthetic because it's so good. So, yeah, that was a bit of a shame. But anyway,
I still can't figure out which version I saw because I'm in Canada. So it says 18 plus.
When we get into the spoiler stuff, we'll get
good.
There. And yeah.
We'll I'm looking at a website with the differences between the versions here, and it actually is pretty minor.
It is minor, but like I say, the effect is more marked than it sounds on paper, I think.
It more comes down to when you've seen the unrated director's cut, you see what they cut and you go, that's dumb. What was the point?
To your point, actually, about sort of appealing to kids, Moises. The other thing, of course, with RoboCop is that there was so much merchandise of this movie. It was merch the hell, to appeal to kids. There was so many toys and models and stuff and comic books and what have you.
Not to promote a long dormant, dearly departed, much missed podcast, but in the episode of Unjustly Maligned where I talked about Alien 3 and how it was the first Alien movie that I saw, and that it was relentlessly marketed with toys for kids for a movie that was absolutely not for kids. Same thing happened with RoboCop. Like in the comics world and in the sequels that don't exist world, Frank Miller became involved in the franchise, and yep. there was this RoboCop versus Terminator thing. And it was the Reagan Thatcher era of give kids toys with guns to shoot the bad guys in black and white narratives about good guys and bad guys. And RoboCop became so explosively popular with those of us who weren't of age to properly watch it that the studio went, oh, well, I guess we need to get this in the toy aisle. Somebody call Hasbro because we need to fit this into a mold that is a parody of what this movie was satirizing.
Well, Frank Miller was involved as early as RoboCop 2. He wrote the script for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting when he wrote those RoboCop versus Terminator comics as well.
It's interesting when you watch the first and the second movies back to back. And I've never actually seen the third movie, but I understand it goes even more in this direction. But
I'll let you understand that you should never see the third
movie. I'm curious about it now, though, because I just found out that Fred Decker was the director. And I love Monster Squad and I love Night of the Creeps, but I know what he would do with RoboCop 3, and I know it would be very, very bad. But it's interesting watching, like, even though 2 is very violent and has a lot of dark stuff in it, it also kind of has that feeling like they're trying to do kind of an E.T.-esque sort of thing, like with funny jokes that the kids will enjoy. And it's that's part of why I think the tone is so off in that, is because it feels like they're sort of trying to pull it towards more of a kids action movie kind of thing. It has like a real vibe, a real Last Action Hero vibe, like the worst parts of Last Action Hero.
I'm glad you said the worst parts.
I hate that we're talking about RoboCop 2, but while we are, I'm going to talk about it.
About it too much. Yeah. We are here to talk about the first.
But I think it does inform an interesting conversation about the movie itself, because it's where this really interesting thing became perverted into something unrecognizable. When what this first movie does and does so well and could stand on his own gets turned into the commodified, well, how can we turn that into a sequel and how can we make a bunch of toys out of this? It became unrecognizable so quickly that it was difficult to remember through all of that marketing how purely straight ahead, stone cold good this first movie is. Where, you know, I made fun of the, you know, poorly disguised Texas shooting locations, but it is really a pretty unimpeachable classic of its era when it comes to the craft and filmmaking and writing and dedication to the bit that is in there, that what came after it is even more sad because of how good this is. And, you know, you go to the remake and it's, come on, guys, they tried exploiting this. This is not going to work. And sure enough, the remake didn't work because it completely lost ground of what this was.
This whole thing is an object lesson. The whole franchise is an object lesson in why you shouldn't try to franchise everything. And I know this was an early version of what we now think of as franchising, but the first movie, to your point, as you said, is so well constructed and so self-contained that it was only ever going to result in, you know, bad things to try and make sequels and spin-offs.
And the ending's perfect. The ending is a perfect place to leave this story off.
It was only while rewatching it, and I have seen this movie several times over the years, but I hadn't seen it maybe for about 10 years until I watched it for this episode. And as I was rewatching, I remembered how much this movie taught me about pacing. Like, there are things in this movie and things in the structure that I still think about today when I am writing stories. And I remember very clearly when I was 15 years old, kind of picking apart and watching it on VHS years later as well, over and over, picking apart the structure and the pacing of it, because it is so well structured and it all fits together. And there's so many smart choices, both in the script and in the direction, which deviates a little from the script, but actually a lot less than you might think, especially for somebody like Verhoeven.
Yeah, my notes literally contain the phrase, this movie is paced perfectly. And it's in a certain way, it's it it's very clearly an 80s movie because so many 80s movies are sort of episodic. You know, you can find sort of individual chunks that make up, this is chapter one and this is chapter two. Like, you know, in this, you've got a segment that's just the character and the setting introduction. Then you have like a whole middle section that's the making of RoboCop. And then you've got the Robo's first night on the beat and so on and so forth. I mean, it's everything
and commercial breaks.
Yeah, and of course the commercial breaks
yeah.
which are frequently the bookends for those segments and make a very clear delineation between the two the different segments. And I think the thing that's most remarkable about this is it's an hour and 42 minutes, which is by today's standards super compact. You know, nothing gets made that's under 2 hours anymore, but it doesn't feel like there's anything missing. It feels like the exact amount of content is in this movie for what it's trying to do. I mean, it's just magnificent.
So yeah, let's sound off the spoiler horn, figuratively, if not literally, as it were, and say, yeah, if you haven't already seen RoboCop, beware, from now on here be spoilers, and you really should go and see it. I think we're all pretty much in agreement on that.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you really hate ultra violence, then stay away.
Except well, okay, this isn't sure. really that yeah. ultra violent anymore by today's standards.
Actually, that's true. Yeah, yeah. You see as much blood and gore
well,
as you do
here.
If you
hate ultra violence,
CSI,
you're still going to hate RoboCop.
That's probably that's true.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So the first thing I'll say post spoiler, and this is going way into the movie, but I only just found this out reading up about it this weekend. Apparently, the original script, when I read the original script, I realized the original script did not have a connection between Clarence Boddicker and Dick Jones. Like they were both in it, but they were not. Boddicker did not work for Dick Jones, and that was a studio note. It's like probably one of the best studio notes ever.
Blind
was them saying,
cetera,
"Hey, why
cetera.
Don't you connect these two?" Yeah.
Hey, as the corporate parent financing this, you should have the corporate organization be corrupt and in league with the criminal.
Yeah, how yeah. ironic that the corporates get it right in this movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, talk about like an example of a really good exec note. So. Yeah, we've talked sort of in generalities. Let's get more specific. One of the things I wanted to, that I always stuck with me about this movie, and I think strikes everyone when they first watch it, even nowadays, I would think, is those commercials. The news broadcasts and the satirical commercials with the smarmy doctor selling you a replacement heart. And
the
yeah,
Series
and
7
the
Sports Heart by Jensen.
Yeah, and the Nukem board game and the SUX 6000 and all that. And they're great, but they're also like so much satire from the 80s. You watch them now and you're just like, that actually looks kind of cute
that's
and
familiar.
Old-fashioned.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, I played the game. There's a board game called Nuclear War, which I played a bunch of times, sure. And it's basically the same thing.
I love Casey Wong and Jess Perkins to death, the talking heads on the news broadcast, Media Break or whatever it's called.
Yeah, and one of them is Liza Gibbons, known to U.S. audiences for Entertainment Tonight.
That's Liza Gibbons?
Gibbons.
I didn't recognize her. She's so made up. But, oh, man, the persistent wan smiles when they return from a story about neutron bombs in South Africa or dead cops. Mm-hmm. It's just like the same sort of doped-up expression.
Well, the Mexico War is going. boy, that was uncomfortable.
The intonation as well, how they deliver the stories is just so spot on, so accurate to
good luck, Frank.
News broadcast.
And like just speaking of the pacing, just jumping into it, like it doesn't waste any time. You get like a long shot of the city,
right?
And boom, right to the title card, and then straight on into the news readers. And you're like, okay, I kind of already have a feeling of what kind of movie I am watching just in the first few moments of it. And then onto the commercials, and then like suddenly we find out, oh, the police are privatized, and it's just like, yeah, that's one of those moments where you're like, oh, this is funny and uncomfortable.
Well, it technically starts with the Orion Pictures logo, which just makes me sad.
Fair.
But then, that cheesy 3D title swooping in over the Detroit skyline with the dramatic musical swell. It just screams, yes, this is the 80s. You are watching an action movie from the 80s.
The thing that the movie doesn't do is take a break to go, oh, here's a title card explaining things. It just immerses us in the world, shows us what the world is like, and you get a feeling for what this world is as you are just thrown directly into the deep end, and you don't feel lost at any point.
That's what I was going to say, because the world building in this is so, again, talking about like not wasting any time. Nothing here is wasted.
True.
All the world building is done like diegetically. It's done economically. It doesn't spoon feed you. That news broadcast, I mean, starting off with a news broadcast is kind of a cliche. It's kind of a clam. It's a bit cheesy. But again, the way it's done, because it feels so accurate, because the delivery is so good, it doesn't actually give you loads of expository stuff. It's all hints, things like the mention of the neutron bomb and unrest in South Africa and the president giving a news conference in space. You know, it's not delivered in a way that kind of says, so now listen while I tell you about this thing. And hey, did you know the president's gone to space? You know, it just gives you the facts as a news story would and relies on you to keep up with it. And it does that throughout the whole movie. There's so much that is not over-explained,
right,
which helps keep it feeling trim and tight, but also, I think, suggests that it respects the audience's intelligence more than people dismissing it as a schlock B movie would anticipate.
And none of it's ridiculous. The news broadcasts and the commercials, they're funny, but they're not so far off of, you know, what you would expect to see that
right. It's not
just
camp.
Like, oh, this is just silly. You know, it's
recognizable.
Like, oh, yeah. I could totally see this dude selling the Series 7 sports art.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the same way that, you know, sketches on A Bit of Fry and Lori were not that far off of reality. But they took seriously the ridiculous assertions of the powers that be on either side of the Atlantic, you know, pushing people in the direction of what this movie embraces as its reality. It's wild to see things that in this day and age, people say with a straight face that what we need are bipedal murder robots patrolling the streets because crime is just way too crazy.
Hey,
trust us.
Progress marches on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that opening scene in the precinct is, I've got that noted here as like, that is a model of economy because you've got, I mean, that line when he walks in and says, you know, I'm transferring from South District. And Reed, the sergeant, says, oh, nice place. We work for a living down here. What a brilliant line. Tells you everything you need to know about the sort of place that he's walked into. You know, we learn that it's a rowdy district. We
that
learn there's unrest in the ranks.
Yep.
Right, we learn they're contemplating a strike. We also learn that Murphy isn't fazed by any of this, that Lewis is tough, that cops wear body armor, which, of course, from here in 2023, their armor actually looks pretty weak compared to what modern cops are wearing, but at the time felt
well,
like,
I mean, it's,
oh my
it's
God,
because now
like
they've figured
the
out
army.
how to slim down those like bomb disposal unit vests that the cops in this movie wear.
And then also the speech about you know, this cop has died. Donations, you know, will be given to the family, given to so-and-so as usual. Just like, boom, you get
delivered
it.
To the Cecil right. as usual. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, they have stated that this is like the 30th cop to die in the last couple of months or whatever at Boddicker's hand. So that's to be expected. No, I just wanted, we had sort of started to talk about the world building, and I just wanted to briefly talk about it a bit more. It's really interesting what they've chosen to do here, because this is presumably supposed to be sometime in the future, right?
Right, but they don't specify a year.
They don't, and it's... If it is the future, this is not a very ambitious vision of the future.
No,
I mean,
it's very cyberpunk.
They can build sophisticated robots, but everything else is basically the same. It's just crappier. I mean, there's lots of cathode ray tubes. There's very few computers. It's hilariously over the urinals in the OCP executive bathroom. The big scientific or the science fiction sop there is stock tickers on those old LED signboards like they have outside of elementary schools.
Yep.
I mean, it's really more like 1987, but with robots. You know?
1987 retrofuturism that says, look, we tried some stuff. It didn't work out. and this was the future we got, and it's not that far from now. So don't get your hopes up, and it could be this bad.
It's almost like they said, well, we could do a bunch of Blade Runner-y kind of stuff, but nah, it's just going to distract from the
well,
point. So,
I mean, that's actually, you know, stepping away into the real world. That wasn't entirely a creative decision, because Ed Neumeier did kind of want to. He was inspired to write this movie after working on Blade Runner for a few days because he was an exec at the studio at the time. They were filming on the lot at the back, and he just basically finagled his way onto the crew. And he wanted this to look like Blade Runner, as well as, you know, sort of having and having Robocop walk around in a sort of Blade Runner landscape. And the producer said, John Davison basically said to him, you can have the streets or you can have the robot. Which do you want? We can't afford both.
Yeah, made the proper choice.
But it was the right choice. Absolutely. You know, the getting the suit right. Right. Was, you know, more important than anything. And again,
and
if
they
you
hired the right
of,
guy for that. I this is the first time I ever saw the credit for who designed it. And when I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, that's clearly Rob Bottin. He's a genius.
Yeah. Yeah. A genius who apparently did barely spoke to Verhoeven throughout the filming. They clashed so badly. They got along so poorly. Yeah. That they just hardly spoke during the filming, but the end result, obviously, to be fair, you know, there's a lot of people have that reaction to Verhoeven and have had that reaction to him over the years. He kind of seems to rub people the wrong way. But, you know, the results do kind of speak for themselves. And, of course, Phil Tippett doing the stop motion on Ed 209 as well. You know, another legendary special effects guy. And it really shows, you know, the Ed 209's animation. I remember at the time, you know, you could tell it was stop motion, but it's really good stop motion. And even now,
it's about as good as stop motion can get.
Yeah.
It's really superb. I mean, it almost still works today. It doesn't, but it almost does.
It's very close.
Well, especially in the character of it, those little touches, like how is one of his toes judders when he falls over, that sort of thing. And the turtle screaming when he falls down the stairs is just,
oh, the sound design has a lot to do with that too. They've chosen to make him like roar like a lion at points and scream like some sort of a
squeal like a baby.
Well, I mean, design elements that carried through and were inspiration for the way that they set up the mech in Metal Gear Solid. I mean, the most obvious lift from this movie in a similarly mega popular thing was Metal Gear Solid going, we're going to do a bipedal T-Rex-ish robot thing that roars. And
speaking of the sound effects, you also have the sound effects just on the RoboCop suit as well.
Yes. Yes.
Like, absolutely sell the thumping and the whirring and the wheezing. And this movie sounds fantastic.
The thumping, especially, when he's being introduced and you don't see him clearly, but you hear the thunk, thunk of his feet is remarkable atmosphere in the sound design. And then, all the little clicks and whirs as he moves.
In the modern superhero movie thing where people's, you know, super armored suits come out of, you know, like a pocket watch or something and have no weight to them, RoboCop has the exact opposite thing going. And it's why it looks so good and why it sells so well is it sells the weight. It sells the actual existing in physical space thing that I'm not saying CG visual effects can't do, but it is...
choose not to do.
Well, choose not to do or run out of time. And it's not on the artists doing this. They're given impossible deadlines by people who go, we'd rather not build a suit. Can we have Steve with the computer, computer it? And that's what I think makes those movies fall down. It's not a lack of potential talent on the side of the visual effects people, but there's always this rush now. So that they can't do the stuff that if you're doing something physical on set like they did for RoboCop, well, either you build it or it doesn't get shot.
Although they almost didn't have time to do it here as well. Part of the reason why Bottin and Verhoeven fell out was because apparently a few months into the design, Verhoeven basically sent Bottin off in a completely different direction and insisted that he do something that looked actually more like Japanese manga giant robot stuff. And it just didn't work. And it took them like 3 months for Verhoeven to admit, okay, no, we screwed it up. This isn't going to work. Go back to what you were doing. But by that time, they'd wasted 3 months of design and building time. And so Bottin was way behind schedule and allegedly literally delivered the suit to set on the first day that it was supposed to be shot. Like the first day that Weller put on the suit was the first day he was filmed in it, which is crazy when you consider how well he moves in it. Like his bodily acting in this film is just incredible.
That's the most amazing thing I think about that design is that it can be moved in and it looks like it's not terribly uncomfortable.
And it was.
I'm sure it was, but I mean it looks realistic and yet it's still capable of enough motion for him to act in it. And
yeah,
I did want to stop briefly and say, Peter Weller's performance in this is really, really remarkable. He's being told basically to do the robot for an hour and 40 minutes and to sell it and make it look like it's realistic. And at the same time, bring that sort of pathos of being, you know, this human that's been locked into this nightmare scenario. And, boy, does he pull it off. It's wild to me that, and it's like, some of it is that great sound design, because of course, you know, when he turns and there's a whir, that certainly adds to your mind going, oh yeah, he's a robot. But that's gotta be very, very difficult to pull off.
He trained with a mime for months, apparently. To sort of, you know, to get these movements right. But the problem was he did that without the suit. And then when he got in the suit, he realized everything that he'd practiced to do, he couldn't do in the suit, which makes it even more remarkable that it actually pulls it off and that it looks good. It's incredible.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Speaking of the weight that the sound implies and, you know, his movements and him being a human, you know, trapped in this thing, it actually, I just now sort of put together, there's the scene in the movie where they have just worked on him and the one of the women doctors is like, we managed to save the arm. Like, no, we don't want that arm, lose it. And they put him back to sleep. And I'm thinking now, like, if they had kept that arm, it probably would be a lot less useful than the other arm, because there is so much weight to this suit. It's all made out of metal. Is a human arm actually going to be able to stand up to, like, lifting a ginormous gun or whatever else he has to do? So, you know, I guess Miguel Ferrer was right.
Yeah, no, as gross as it is, that's clearly the right decision.
Yeah.
But that does have that scene does have like the best line satirically in the movie, which is, well, he signed the release form when he joined the force. He's legally
the release
dead.
Form.
We can do pretty much what we want.
Yeah.
Lose the arm.
You know, the thermograph scene where he goes to the mayor's office, you know, there's the hostage situation and he's walking down the corridor, he looks through the wall, you get the thermal vision of the people walking around. Well, remember, this was filmed in 1986. Like, there was no such thing as, you know, thermal vision, or certainly not for the kind of budget that this film had. So they filmed that by putting the actors in coloured body stockings. Like, their body stockings painted with colors to look like thermograph images and then filmed it with a polarized lens. And once you know that, if you watch that scene, you can tell, right? But you can only tell when you know, it's so brilliantly done that if you don't know, you just assume that it's some kind of special effects or something, but actually it's far more lo-fi than that.
Wow.
I love those kind of cheap, you know, what can we do? How can we achieve this effect without spending billions and billions of dollars?
And Steve with his computer hasn't even been born yet.
Yeah.
Steve.
It's true.
Friggin' Steve.
That guy.
Oh, man. We have to talk about that, the famous Ed 209 scene, partly because it is the scene that everybody focuses on and talking about the sort of cartoonish style of the violence, what have you.
Not the cool scenes that we see of TJ Laser, noted blockbuster TV show.
I love TJ Laser, just cracks me up. But one of the things, again, at coming back to this theme, it's so well done in terms of storytelling and pacing, because we've all seen the poster. We know that this film is called RoboCop, The Future of Law Enforcement, and Dick Jones stands in front of the door and says, I present to you the future of law enforcement. And the doors open, and of course, you think it's going to be RoboCop, and it's not. It's the Ed 209. Just such a brilliant little bait and switch for the audience to kind of introduce a new character, but also catch you on the hop, and then also show you, obviously, that this character is completely useless, but also so iconic. That voice, which apparently was just a temporary voice. That's the producer, John Davison, again. He just did that as a temporary voice, and it was so good that they kept it. And then obviously the scene with him shooting the guy 50, 60 times after saying, I am now authorized to use necessary force. It's like one guy with a handgun. And I love that he falls back onto the model of Delta City as well. You know, and again, they don't make too much of it. It's just there. You see it, you know, relying on the audience to pick that up. And then that final line.
They don't cut to a slow-mo shot of him falling on it again and again.
Yeah.
Just double and triple underlining, hey, dummies, in case you didn't get the symbolism going on.
And then that final line when, like, the smoke's pluming out of Ed 209's guns and somebody shouts, somebody want to call a paramedic? it's so good. It's so good. And
it's followed up by them sort of coolly discussing this. This is a setback. This is going to be a setback.
And how, like, you know, the big boss is upset, but he's not so much upset that they just lost an employee and a man has died.
No,
he's upset. $50 million
in interest.
Yeah, exactly. Like this project that we had so much money in is a failure. It clearly doesn't work. That's what I'm annoyed about. So, you know, somebody needs to do something about it.
Yeah. He's brilliant as well. I can't remember the name.
Mm-hmm. He's Dan O'Hurley is the guy.
That's him.
And
yeah.
I know him mostly from Halloween 3, the season of The Witch, where he is superbly creepy.
But he plays that character so well. I mean, obviously, he's only on screen for maybe a total of like 6-7 minutes, including, you know, this and then at the end. But he makes his mark on the film in that short time. And then I'm sorry, I'm terrible with names. I've forgotten the actor's name who plays Dick Jones.
Oh, Ronnie Cox.
Ronnie Cox, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who up until that point was known for playing really, really nice, normal guys, and then comes along and gets offered this part. And by all accounts, he said in interviews since, had like more fun than he'd ever had on set in his life playing this terribly, terribly, dastardly evil man. And then, of course, went on to be a villain in loads of other movies in the 80s.
I don't think I've ever seen him in anything where he's a good guy. I've always seen him be the sinister kind of creep.
Mm-hmm. Right, but this was the first one.
RoboCop.
Dick Jones is a great villain, too. I really enjoy the touch of realism that they made him kind of old and unhip. Like, he's got that line where he's trying to intimidate Bob Morton, and he says, I used to call the old man funny names, Iron Butt, Boner.
Yeah.
And he's like expecting like Bob Morton to be shocked he calls him Buddy Boy while he's trying to intimidate him, for crying out loud. Yeah,
yes, Bob Morton, I use such rough language as Iron Butt.
Oh, no.
I am edgy, fellow kid.
That whole sequence shows you sort of how disconnected everybody in this whole company is from the reality on the ground and what normal people are actually living. And, you know, it really does a great job of sort of selling the corporate atmosphere. And at the time, I'm sure the first time I saw this, I was kind of like aghast at the idea that, you know, they have this presentation about how, you know, we've done a whole bunch of work in areas that were formerly known as nonprofit, like hospitals and prison and space exploration. And I'm watching it now and just going, ugh. Because it was uncomfortably prescient at that moment. And, you know, later you get the line like, there's no better way to make money than free enterprise. And I was just like, I need to put my head down for a little bit now.
I like them going down in the elevator, and Robertson says to Bob Morton, it's too bad about Kitty. And the response is, that's life in the big city. Sometimes you just get shredded by a giant robot in your boardroom. It's just how it works.
Shrug.
And this is all very deliberate on Ed Neumeier's part. This was a big part of what he wanted to do with the script. He's talked about how you know, in the 80s on Wall Street, things like the Book of Five Rings, which is, for heaven's sake, a book written for samurai about how to kill people more effectively, was considered, you know, a text that everybody on Wall Street had to read in order to be a sort of great corporate raider and stuff. And how ridiculous that is, which it is transparently ridiculous, but it still goes on today. And that whole yuppie culture and the primacy of money and profit above everything was a big part of what he was trying to satirize and not expose exactly, but, you know, get across with those scenes. And I think he did that brilliantly because, yeah, they are so ridiculously unconnected, as you said, Erica, from the real world, from real people's concerns. So well done.
Well, he fixed it. So mission accomplished. Good job. Yeah. We're on Bob Morton, I just want to throw a huge shout out to Miguel Ferrer here for his doing his best William Atherton as giant 80s a-hole.
He's so good
in this. You just make every movement. It's like, this is the most arrogant prick in the entire world.
Miguel Ferrer also, he and Bill Mumy grew up like Hollywood kids, and Ferrer like got known for roles like this, but like they were like Hollywood nerds who, I mean, they collaborated on comics for Marvel. I love that he is a nerd done good who ended up being in so many things like RoboCop that are beloved by his people, as it were. Because he gets the tropes, he gets the archetypes that are at play. And I think part of why he's so good in this role and in so many others within genre, is that he loves it as much as we do. And he takes it seriously for that reason. And so, yes, there's like some over the top stuff. But he not to say that he didn't work hard in every role that he ever did, but you can see this added like edge of energy that he put into the nerdier speculative fiction stuff that he got to work on.
I love the little details he puts into his performance too. Like there's a scene in the boardroom where they're sort of panning past everybody and they go by him and there's this little subtle sniff, which, mm-hmm. you know, his nose is bleeding 24 hours a day. And it's just this totally like random little sniff he threw in there. But it's like, yeah, that's exactly what he would be doing right now. Mm-hmm.
Honestly, one of my only complaints about this entire movie is the fact that when you have the scene with him and the two girls at his obnoxiously fancy home and he's sniffing cocaine off of the one girl's bosom and he turns around and there's no powder on his nose. And I was like, there should be powder on his nose.
No.
That's the only time that I was pulled out of the movie.
Call IMDb goofs.
That's just a sign that he's good at what he does.
Hey, no wasted cocaine, man. It all goes in the nose.
One of the little touches like that that I love from him is after the shooting in the boardroom, when they're all sort of, you know, when Ed-209's been powered down and everybody realizes it's safe, when Johnson, his, you know, sort of deputy, has been kind of pressed up against him, and the way he just kind of shoves him off and gives him that kind of get away from me look is just a lovely little bit of, you know, non-verbal acting, just a lovely little touch that says so much about his character. Can we also talk about, and we'll get to, I know we all want to talk about You Know Who, and we'll get to him in a moment, but I think we need to give a shout out to Nancy Allen as well, because this, again, was a role that was kind of against type for her, to the point where she had her hair cut 8 times apparently for this role, in terms of like getting shorter and shorter, because she was known for obviously having these lovely long locks and being this sort of screen beauty. And Verhoeven said, like, the first thing he said to her was, "You're great, but cut your hair because I want
Lose
you
the
to
hair.
Look." Yeah, I don't want you to look feminine. And she cut it, and he's like, no, not short enough. And she eventually cut it 8 times till it got to that really short length that it is in the movie. And she also put on weight by stopping smoking so that she didn't look kind of svelte.
That's dedication.
It really is, yeah. But she's
look,
great.
You signed the release
so
form
good.
When you joined the production. We can cut your hair any way we want.
Yeah. We can do anything you want with you. But she's so great in it. I mean, she doesn't have a lot to work with. She doesn't have an awful lot to do other than be his psychic, apart from when she rescues him, you know, from the shooting at the bottom of the OCP tower. But what she has and what she does with it, I think, is so good and just kind of such great character work to get across a good character with so little material.
Yeah, it's interesting that this movie is as progressive as it is in terms of, like, it's really not as sexist as I expected it to be when I went back and watched it a couple of months ago. Because, I mean, in a way, it does sort of fall into that trap of girls being like a character type, like from Dungeons and Dragons, you have your group and there's one girl. And that's not, but the thing is here, it's not because Lewis is written in any way as not like other girls. She's just a cop. It's never referred to like, oh my God, she's the girl cop or anything like that. It's just more the casting of the rest of the movie. Like, I appreciate that we actually get a decent number of women as the doctors and scientists who are putting together RoboCop. But when it comes to the rest of the cast, it's, you know, you have a woman as a secretary. You have the two, you know, smart is so sexy women doing a bunch of cocaine with Miguel Ferrer and not a lot else. But it's never... It's sort of the kind of baked in sexism that you're just going to get in any movie in 1987. And it really, I think, rises above a lot of the rest simply because they don't make a big deal about the fact that Lewis happens to be a woman. She just comes in and she's a really tough cop because she kicks somebody's ass right there in the middle of the precinct and then gets introduced to her new partner and everything's cool. And it's not a big deal. And that was very refreshing because I was a little bit worried when I went to rewatch it again a few months ago.
Well, you'll be happy to hear that in RoboCop 2, they broke the glass ceiling and finally introduced a horrible woman in the boardroom, too. So.
True, yeah. Oh, but yeah, that opening scene where she kicks that guy's ass in the precinct is just, I mean, it's not very long. And it, again, kind of a cliche to introduce somebody like that, but it's so good. And mm-hmm. I remember when I was 15 watching that for the first time, I kind of fell in love with Nancy Allen a little bit in that scene when she takes off her helmet and I'm like, oh yeah. It's a woman, oh my God, it was just so good.
It's like the end of Metroid.
I mean, in terms of like putting it in its historical point, you know, this was her breaking out of being, oh, Brian De Palma's ex-wife who was in Dress to Kill and Blowout. And now, and you know, she's
and Carrie,
you know, kicking ass
and Carrie,
taking names.
That's the only thing I knew Carrie, her from prior to this. Yeah, where she is a very different character.
Yep,
getting her to break out like that has often been there are tropes about it now of going, oh, we're just going to make her a tough, strong woman who like punches somebody twice when we introduce her or something like that. That has not been done well in other movies is done incredibly well here, because it isn't gratuitous. It doesn't go on and on. It isn't underlined by really bland dialogue going, wow, she's really the toughest cookie in the Detroit PD or any garbage like that.
The chief is just like, it's another day with, Lewis kicking somebody's ass.
Oh, there's Lewis kicking somebody's ass again.
When
gosh,
you're done
Lewis,
screwing
you're
around
incorrigible,
with your suspect, would you get over here? It's great stuff.
It really is. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the villains then. And obviously Clarence Boddicker, who has to rank as one of the greatest action villains of the 80s, I think. Partly because, again, talking about playing against type, I mean, I don't know about Kurtwood Smith in terms of sort of characters he played, but just his look, his appearance, the fact that he's wearing glasses goes
he's
against...
He's not what you would expect, for sure.
Right, no. So many of the sort of stereotypical gangster villain types of the 80s.
In fact, I think back on RoboCop, I usually sort of replace him with Michael Ironside. I had forgotten it was Kurtwood Smith when I rewatched him.
Who, funnily enough, they actually wanted to play RoboCop originally, but he turned it down, and anyway, they thought he would have been too big.
Look, here's how you know Clarence Boddicker is a tough as nails, takes no prisoners kind of guy. His gang not only includes Ray Wise, but it also includes Paul McCrane.
Right. So. See, and that's the problem, is I get my ER actors mixed up.
Hey, Ray Wise is brilliant in this. He, so again, talking about roles that have very, very little and yet making the most of them, he is so good. But Clarence Boddicker, man, I mean, apparently he was written to have glasses to resemble Heinrich Himmler.
Wow.
Which, yeah. Sure. But to me, he always looked like
That sounds like a very Verhoeven thing to do.
Right, right. But to me, he always looked like William Gibson with attitude. Like, he looks like a nerd.
Are you saying Gibson doesn't have attitude?
Yeah.
Gibson.
He's obviously a psycho, but he's also obviously smart. And it makes such a nice change again, at the time in the 80s, to those sort of boneheaded, muscle-bound bad guys, then he's absolutely not. But he is completely ruthless. And again, Smith just does such a great job, I think, with that character. The spitting blood on the sergeant's desk blotter, apparently that was improvised. That was Smith's own idea. It was like, you know, just for a bit of extra attitude. And again, it's an iconic moment.
Yeah, he's really good in this. And I only really know him from that 70s show beyond this. And I had never made the connection before reviewing it this time. So I was like, oh no, it's that guy. Wait a minute,
really?
I'm having a disconnect here.
Yeah, and like that whole cast of weirdos that are his crew is just, I mean... the laughing. I cannot handle the laughing.
Oh yeah.
from Johnson, I think it is. Ugh.
Does it hurt?
Which I think may also have been improvised actually, because that's not in the script during that scene. I think in the script he just says something like, I'm out of ammo. And that's when Bodica steps in and says, okay, I'll finish this.
And things in the modern day are so well documented, like their onset rewrites and that sort of thing, you know, beyond things that are ad-libbed. But this comes from a time where it might have been ad-libbed on the day. It might have gone into a script revision that isn't like the finished official shooting script, you know, beyond there having been various different versions. There was a version of the script where Murphy didn't have a family at all. Verhoeven had it cut out. And then similarly to his wife interceding and going, no, you should do this movie. She said, no, he does need to have a family. and it completely changes the movie.
Thank goodness for Verhoeven's wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Sounds like he's a lot to put up with in general. So good for her all around.
Yeah.
Indeed. Talking about the Murphy death scene. So here's where we get to find out which version Erica saw.
Yes.
First of all, you have that thing where he blows off Murphy's hand with the shotgun in an absolutely brilliant special effect. I remember everybody just went at that when we saw it in the cinema because it's so well done.
Yeah, just like liquefies. It's pretty gnarly.
If you watch it back now, again, like sort of with the benefit of freeze frame stuff, you can see that what they essentially do is drag the hand off at high speed. They literally pull the hand away from the prosthetic arm at high speed. And then, you know, you've got the squib of blood going as well. But it's obviously only a few frames long, so the effect is brilliant. But then later on, right at the end, when he's on his knees and Emil says, hey, he's still alive. And Clarence steps in and goes, all right, fun's over. And points the pistol at him. In the theatrical version, you get a very brief shot of Peter Weller just kind of staggering a little bit and his hair flops around. And then you cut to sort of to Bodica shooting and that's it. And you don't see sort of any more than that.
And he doesn't say, hey, he's still alive in that version either.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about that one. In the director's cut, you get a full, like, 3 to 4 second shot of Weller on his knees, screaming, kind of leaning backwards. The camera moves around him to the back, and then you see Bodica shoot, and you see the back of the head blown off. And that's the massive prosthetic, or dummy, I should say, that I was talking about earlier. Right, so that is the director's cut, yeah. But that is brilliant, because again, unless you freeze frame and watch it sort of step by step, you won't even realize that it's not Weller. It's a really, really well done dummy of him that they rigged up so they could animate the jaw, make it move, make it sort of shake as if it was trembling with fear, and then obviously have the explosive and the squib in the back so that they could blow it out when Bodica shoots him. But it's such a brilliant effect. And to think that wasn't even on screen in the theatrical version, what a waste.
And now I've got to go find the director's cut.
Yeah, you do.
It is really well done, honestly.
Although it does seem weird that they would use a guy for RoboCop who got shot through the brain. Does it seem like the ideal candidate, really?
Yeah, we can replace that part of the brain with computer chips.
Morton needed to move fast.
Yeah, maybe that's the part they wanted to take out anyway.
Yeah, they said they're going to wipe the memory anyway, so, you know.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, maybe it was the bullet through the brain that actually allowed him to keep as many memories as he did and let him have some dreams.
Right. Oh, yeah, you're going to take him offline because of a dream? another great scene from Ferrer. The other sort of villain and big special effect thing we have to talk about, I guess, is Emil going into the toxic waste tank.
If you're going to take away only one image from this film, toxic waste Paul McCrane is the likely candidate.
It really is.
I think it's the melty fingers that really do it for me. The fingers just hanging off of the bones.
That's horrible. It's absolutely great. Horrible.
It's the Cronenberging of Paul McCrane that really works so well where Verhoeven went, hey, can we do something really gross?
And when he gets hit by the car and just liquefies, it's beautiful.
Splash.
Exactly, yeah. The makeup is terrible. And by the way, that is written. If you read the fourth draft of the script is the one I read, which has stuff in it that didn't make it into the movie, but Emil melting... I mean, it's written slightly differently, but the description is there. It clearly was in the script. But yeah, that effect, the makeup is so good. But then, yeah, driving through him and he just disintegrates.
80s audiences were just wild for toxic waste.
Washes up the windshield.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Really not that different from his character arc in Fame either. I actually have no recollection of what happens in Fame. I just thought that sounded good.
It was another of those moments, as you say, it's one of the moments that everybody remembers from the film. And when I watched it, certainly, you know, me and my friends, I remember it all just being grossed out and horrified and also elated and just overjoyed at that scene.
That's
it
the
is
comic
just
bookiest
so
moments in
except
in the,
you know what,
in
I don't think everybody remembers it because I completely forgot about it. Because you know why, it has nothing to do with the movie. It doesn't have anything to do with the plot. It's just to me it feels like a weird off note, like suddenly we're in like the toxic Avenger, like a toxic waste can happens to just be sitting there and this guy turns it, like, no, I'm watching a science fiction movie about a future corporate dystopia where they've turned the police into robots. Like, why am I suddenly getting weird toxic of like just toxic waste not acting the way actual toxic
What's
waste
more
does.
Dystopian just, than toxic waste?
I don't know. To me, it felt very cartoony is the right word for it. And just to me, it was kind of like an off note. And yeah, I laughed, but I forgot about it after the first few times I saw it. And I had forgotten it again, even though I watched the movie just two months ago. And I was like, oh, right, this part. And yeah, so it's fine. I appreciate that a lot of fellas loved it. But for me, it was just a nothing.
I'm not coming out in defense of it necessarily, but Erica, you say that's not how toxic waste works. How do you know that in this near future, they didn't come up with specifically body swelling and liquefying toxic waste? It's a new kind that's just coming to market for a specific set of needs that no one has.
It's great, by the way, that old Detroit has so many old factories where they can just keep all their toxic waste. They don't need to worry about digging bunkers.
Well, Steve, you gotta have a good surplus of factories so that you have somewhere to make sparks and smoke.
It's a steel foundry.
It's the same one. It's the same steel mill. And the fact that they get it back there, but this time it's the bad guys coming for the good guys at the steel mill in a complete reversal of the opening, I think is a lovely elliptical touch. But sure. I will defend the toxic waste moment because what it does, and maybe I'm reading too much.
Erica all with her hands crossed behind a folding table.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think this is, if you look at that whole climax from the moment the bad guys turn up at the steel mill, basically, and, you know, Murphy and Lewis are obviously setting traps and waiting for them. It is quite intense, lots of explosions, lots of gunfire, not an awful lot of dialogue. It's a fairly sort of just intense, long action scene. And what the toxic waste scene does is give us a moment of levity and relief in the middle of that scene, just before it gets really intense again, before you get Leon dropping the girders on RoboCop and, you know, Clarence fighting him and what have you. It comes just before then. And gives us this, as I say, this moment of levity, this moment of comic relief before that intensity. So you've got intensity at the start, ramping up, then a moment of relief, and then the intensity rebuilds again towards the very climax in the sort of water-bound quarry. And so I think actually from a pacing point of view, from a just a current kind of editing craft point of view, it does belong in the movie and it does sort of earn its place.
I will agree that it absolutely does that. I hadn't thought about it in those terms before, in terms of sort of like the swells and ebbs of the intensity. But I would have preferred that they achieve that end in a different way
with
that doesn't take me out of the movie
waste.
Quite so much.
I just like super gross stuff, frankly. So.
I mean, there's so much super gross stuff you can do with, like, I don't know, molten steel falling on somebody, or like, you know, somebody getting perforated by a bunch of those steel bars that Lewis was sleeping on earlier, or like, there's a lot you can work with there. And just, I don't know, to me, toxic waste feels like an easy out. That's all I'm saying.
It didn't look too easy to me. I love that this sort of... the keening noise that he makes while he's stumbling around. It's so creepy.
Yeah, it is really well played.
Speaking of Emil, I just want to go back to the scene where he is at the gas station gassing up and there's a Shell attendant who's, you know, reading a book and going to college, simply because the actor who plays that Shell attendant is the son of my elementary school art teacher.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Awesome.
Glenning in Erica Ford.
That is fantastic. So, yeah, I mean, the climax, again, like I said, I love the kind of elliptical nature of it being back at the steel mill, but for good reasons. Like, you know, the lazy, silly way would have been for the bad guys to keep on staying at the steel mill.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, which Thank would God. Have been silly, but we've all seen movies where that sort of silliness happens.
I mean, the 80s and 90s, especially in Hong Kong, were built for that. People right. hanging out at disused steel mills. It was just a Wednesday afternoon.
Right, but the fact that they don't do that, the villains have moved on, and so the good guys use it as their base, and then the villains come for them there. As I say, I just think that's a lovely parallel.
I think it's cool.
Yeah, a great way to, you know, sort of have the climax and finale happen at the same place, where the death before the resurrection, as Verhoeven puts it, takes place. Although the quarry with the water at the bottom is kind of... Where does that come from? That doesn't feel like something that belongs in a steel mill, and we don't see it in the opening section there at all. It's a bit odd, but it does make, obviously, for that brilliant visual of Robocop getting completely pommeled by the steel girders that Leon drops on him, which, again, is another great effect. You know, if you watch it frame by frame, you can see that it's clearly a dummy that's being crushed by these. I think they were just painted wood, these girders, but it's so effective. He looks, and because of the sound design, he looks like he's just being completely flattened by this stuff.
And Ray Wise is pretty surprisingly good with a conveniently placed construction crane.
Yeah.
The fact that he knows how to use it, yeah, he's just like, oh, wow, okay.
Maybe that was his job before this, you know, dystopia shut down all the steel mills.
That's right. That's why he's so bitter.
Yeah. That's why he had to turn to crime.
Mm-hmm.
He's not called Wise.
It's a tragic tale, really.
He's really the tragic center of this film, is Ray Wise.
Oh, man. And then, yeah, obviously the other brilliant bit of foreshadowing is when you get the data spike midway through the movie to sort of access the data and then using it as the weapon to take out Bodica in a really, again, sound design, really kind of visceral, gross stabbing when he pulls out a chunk of flesh afterwards.
I love the huge splatter of blood that drops onto Robocop's chest when he pulls that data spike out. So they don't show the actual spiking. I suspect that probably would have been removed if they had, but just this giant clump of blood and tissue that falls out and goes splat is as grisly as you could possibly get.
Is that not in there in the director's cut? Because I thought I remembered seeing it.
No, it is. So in the director's cut, you get the spike and you see him get stabbed, but it's kind of partly off screen. And then he pulls out his hand and you get the gush of blood.
Right.
In the theatrical, you see those actions, but it's all done at a distance, I believe. It's done in sort of medium and long shots rather than that close up. So that's the difference there. But it's you still effectively get the same effect. Apparently, they originally wanted him to shove it through Bodica's eye. Right. But they decided that actually there was no way they'd get that past the ratings board. So why even bother going to the trouble and spending the money?
I waste the time on the effect.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, after that, you go straight to the boardroom, you know, Dick, you're fired. And the infamously terrible blue screen falling Dick Jones.
It's pretty bad.
It really is dreadful. It's even in 1987, I remember thinking that is really just awful.
I forget about it immediately because then they've got that quick scene of Johnson smiling and giving the thumbs up, which just slays me. Just kills me. Yeah. He's just so happy and cheerful. And he's like, hey, good job.
We did it.
And the old man obviously, what's your name, son, Murphy. But what I love about that whole thing is it's so short. Again, you know, we're talking about the economy.
What's the epilogue, really? I mean, the RoboCop's last stand, as I call it, is probably really the climax of the movie.
Yeah, this is falling action.
And then you got to clean up the the loose end of having Dick Jones still around. And it's an economical and perfect, I think, in terms of being short like that.
Right, and you even get that comedy moment where he takes out the Ed 209 guarding the building downstairs, which again is just done really quickly.
And it's basically like an old school Dalek that isn't able to fly. Right. Like, oh no, stairs, gasp.
But there was,
and it's super dumb that the legs keep moving after the head's blown off, but it's worth it.
It works, yeah. But there was originally another epilogue after that. I mean, you're right, Steve. I think, you know, we can consider this to be the real epilogue, but originally there was a whole other scene after this with like more news reports and Lewis recovering in hospital and RoboCop back out on the streets in his car patrolling and somewhere there's a crime happening. And thank goodness that they didn't use any of that, because ending it where it does is just perfect. I mean, that's the sort of thing that has audiences on their feet and applauding.
Right. Murphy, and he smiles, and then it's just boom, RoboCop.
Yeah, again, the economy and the sort of the tightness of this movie is incredible. Like, not a moment is wasted.
Yeah, kudos to whoever did the editing, because it's a fantastic job.
It really is. No denouement. I've got my notes here. Bang, no denouement, no epilogue, just smash the title. 1 hour, 37 minutes, no messing around.
The thing that, the second and third movies exist, the remake exists. The thing that, when I found out there was a sequel, not knowing there was a sequel when I was younger, was I like the what ifs of the self-contained movie on its own, where Murphy tells Lewis, oh, they'll fix you right up, and I'm like, they're gonna make Lewis a RoboCop. Oh,
they
man.
Fix everything.
Oh wow, yep. That's gonna be so cool.
That is a good one.
And then they made the follow-ups, and the things that I thought as the audience who loved it were the interesting what ifs. Not apparently the interesting what ifs that the people in charge of the studio cared about at all.
Well, all they cared about was getting a sequel out as quickly as possible. Neumeier talks about this, where they wanted him to work on the sequel, but they wanted it done so quickly that he was already by that point committed to doing something else. And he was like, yeah, you'll have to wait. I'm doing this other film. And they're like, no, well, tough. Goodbye then. And he says that was his first real exposure to Hollywood studio politics. And he said, bearing in mind, this was a studio that was happy with everything I'd done. And they still basically said, well, sucks to be you then. We're going to go and do it without you. Because that's how it works.
Have we talked about the score yet?
No. We have not. No,
and we should, because Basil Poulidoris' score is very fantastic. Good, yeah.
It's so good and so great that the bits of it that are reused in the sequels are like, this music is so good.
They don't reuse the iconic theme in the second one.
Yeah, they don't use the theme. They went. How can we use something that sounds kind of like the music in the first one, but that isn't remotely as good? And it's like you're drinking. Hey, can I have a Dr. Pepper? Yeah, here you go. And you're like, wait, this is Dr. Thunder. This is not Dr. Pepper. What? What? You can just tell that it's store brand score that is meant to evoke what there was. And for a minute you go, oh, this sounds kind of like it. And that's, I don't know. I keep going on about the sequels, but it's you want to give them credit for trying that is completely unearned. And
but the point is that the score to the first movie is really, really good. And they should have absolutely used those motifs.
Yeah, the weird like cover interpretations of that they use that tries to sound like this. It just doesn't work. It's one of the many reasons those movies don't work. What Polidorus did on this movie, I mean, it would be echoed in games like Metal Gear Solid, in loads of like military stealth action games and that sort of thing. Beyond, the Terminator 2 score stuff that those draw from, this became part of the lexicon of, militarized action, cinematic storytelling.
And what's funny about this theme, well, first of all, I love that they hold off on that iconic theme until 30 minutes in when he drives out on the beat for the first time.
Yeah.
And if you want to take a scene that's basically just a dude driving around a city and nothing else, totally static shot, and make it feel completely epic, that's how you do it. Because, I mean, they really could have titled it the RoboCop Drives Around theme, because it's almost exclusively used just when he's going from place to place in his car. And it's so good. I never really looked up. I didn't know what Polidorus had done previously, so I finally went and looked it up, and he did both of the Conan movies. And think about it, that da 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 is very much a swords and sorcery theme with some metallic clanks laid over the top of it.
Yeah,
and it works so well. So it made perfect sense to me after I heard that, but I was like, wow, that's an interesting parallel there.
Well, and it's that combination. That combination is very deliberate of as you said, sort of the clinks and clangs and the synthesizer bits with the sweeping orchestra to kind of mirror the man and machine theme of the film. I saw him mention that, that was a very deliberate choice, but you're right, it works so well. I didn't know he'd done the Conan things, but that makes absolute sense.
I mean, you can totally picture him taking down a some sort of a monster with his sword to that
snake-headed monster. Yeah,
without the metallic clanks. Well, maybe some metallic clanks.
I mean, bringing up fantasy makes me think. A couple little things that I don't think are like big huge topics, but as much of a police near alt future science fiction-ish thing as this is, like, there are elements of fantasy, there are elements of monster movies in it. RoboCop dreaming is this cybernetic Frankenstein thing. It's a Frankenstein story of a sort. There are those really some of those mythic poses are very Conan the Barbarian, Sumerian, guy with a giant sword. It's just this guy has a giant gun that comes out of his leg. It's wonderful seeing that language cross over in so many respects in this thing that is like, he's a cyborg cop in Detroit, and he drives a beat up old police cruiser and is the most sophisticated killing machine on the planet. I love that marbling in the text of the movie. And it's something that I don't think gets enough credit here in the long view, where people would just go, oh yeah, it's great, and it influenced this, and it's this, and this is what it is. I think those are some of the things that got lost, I think, in the franchisization of RoboCop itself.
Oh, that's, that's a tale as old as time itself, isn't it? Is people being influenced by stuff that's on the surface and not looking down into the layers of text beneath it. That happens with so many things. One thing that is all surface, though, but actually works in terms of the world building and the layers that we were talking about that we haven't mentioned yet that we really have to, is Bixby Snyder. And I'd buy that for a dollar, which is so... I love those segments because we're never told what it is. We're never actually, there's no explanation of what's going on or why it's funny or who this man is or anything, but it is so recognizable. It was apparently done as a kind of deliberate over-the-top parody of Benny Hill, which I can absolutely see.
Yep.
But it is so obviously like lowest common denominator, easy comedy that all the blue-collar people think is hilarious. And we're just going like, why is this funny? It says so much about that world, and also reflects our own world that I think, it's not even in the movie that much, and yet it's one of the enduring catchphrases from the film.
To be fair, it's the blue-collar men that think it's hilarious, because there is the scene in the liquor store where the dude's wife is just completely nonplussed, and the man is just laughing uproariously about this stupid thing.
But, yeah, but later, Emil is watching it and, you know, breaks the window of the TV store in order to turn it up and hear it to laugh at it all the more. It's it is nice how ubiquitous it is and how we see it in so many different contexts and see how many different people see it and recognize it and appreciate it. And in the case of the wife in the convenience store, don't appreciate it.
Yeah,
it's funny that he has to hear the iconic phrase. That's why he breaks the window. Like, you could just watch it through the window, but if you don't hear
that,
"I'll buy that for a dollar," then you haven't really experienced it properly.
Yeah, you really have to hear it in, you know, proper monaural sound. You know, you just need one channel for that to really ring in your ears.
But it's only $1. Really loud.
Also, the genius of having that on the TV in the liquor store during RoboCop's first real takedown, when he throws the guy through the refrigerator and then walks out, and we immediately see the shot of the liquor store couple, and then the TV says, "I'll buy that for a dollar." I mean, it's the perfect punctuation to that scene.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, the liquor store scene where he does more damage to the liquor store than the than the thief would have.
Well, he thanks them for their cooperation.
Yeah, he destroys the place, thanks them, and in walking away, you know, says without words, "You're welcome."
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's almost as good as the delivery of the woman that he rescues. Like, "Madam, you have suffered an emotional shock. I will notify a ripe crisis center." Just the delivery in that is so mechanical, so great.
Now, one thing I did want to bring up. We haven't talked about Paul Verhoeven himself much, other than that he's probably a fairly prickly character. his reputation as a director is, I would say, somewhat infamous. I think the things that usually get mentioned about him are the over-the-top violence and sex. And if people are feeling charitable, they'll mention the somewhat heavy-handed satire, which I think could probably be laid at the feet of the writers more anyway. But I don't think he gets enough credit for how smart his directorial decisions are. This movie has so many moments where it's like, this is the perfect choice for this scene. For instance, that scene where Murphy dies and we're in the first person and the screen fades to black.
Yes.
We hear the medical team, they call the time of death, and then for 5 seconds there's nothing, and then the screen bursts into static as they turn on RoboCop. That's such a smart way to do that transition. And
that's in the script. But I agree that Verhoeven handles it really well.
He does. And then I think that also is partly the decision to hold off a bit on the reveal of RoboCop.
Yes.
It's actually a bummer that they put him on the poster because the delay of the reveal of the design is very well done.
And that's that not in the script. Actually,
cool.
in the script, he just walks into the precinct along with Bob Morton and everybody else. And yeah,
right.
I agree that that scene where he walks in and you only see glimpses of him and through the marbled glass and then from behind and stuff is, yeah, brilliantly done.
And just before that, he's being sort of introduced by Bob Morton and he's walking forward past the applauding OCP crowd. And as he walks forward, you see just a glimpse of him walk by on the monitor, which is another one of those great, you know, "We're not going to show you everything. We're just going to tease you." And then they don't, again, show him in its entirety until he arrives at the police station a few minutes later.
That was actually written to be a mirror, and it says you get a glimpse of chrome, I think is how it's written. But it works so much better as a TV monitor because it fits with the aesthetic of the workshop where he's being built.
And it's so many great, great decisions here. I think the other one I wanted to highlight was the whole segment towards the end where he's being attacked by the SWAT team. There's a sequence where he walks into the room and they turn all their lights on him on their cars. They have spotlights that they fire towards him. And there's this sort of disorienting over-the-shoulder camera position and his head is moving from side to side as they turn him on. And it just it gets across that like confusion and betrayal so well. And then the whole rest of that as he's being fired on and increasingly deteriorating, like his leg goes out at one point and there's a shot from the front of him on the ground, sort of dragging his leg with his hand up. And there's smoke swirling around and the SWAT team advancing from behind him in this sort of dark, shadowy, amorphous blob of gunfire that's coming in his direction. That it's just really, really well done. And I think that one you can lay almost entirely at the feet of the director. I mean, he knows how to stage an action scene like that and make it resonate in ways that it wouldn't otherwise.
Agreed, yeah. And you're right, the sense of betrayal that you feel when he walks out and finds himself surrounded by the SWAT team, I think is quite palpable. I think it's fair to say about Verhoeven that, like, he has not always made good films. You know,
you don't say.
We can all think of a few bad films that he's made, but they're always interesting, even if they're interesting because they're, you know, unsuccessful. And I don't think anybody would say that he doesn't give it his all. You know, like even the bad films, it is clear that he put the work into them, and the end result may have been not great, but you know, you can't deny that he clearly put the work in, put the hours in, and sort of, you know, had, shall we say, good intentions at the very least. I think he was trying something
all the time.
I think we can all agree, yeah, well, certainly we all agree here, that RoboCop is just, it's a genuine classic. It's, you know, it deserves its status as one of the greatest sci-fi action movies around, to the point where it was so innovative that at the time, critics apparently, like, struggled to define its genre because they were so unused to the idea that sci-fi movies could also be satirical and funny and have, you know, a heart and humanity and stuff.
Yeah, it's got pathos too. That's the wild thing. Like, the whole struggle as he, you know, suddenly becomes human again, sort of, you know, he recovers his humanity, climaxing in that scene where he's walking through his house and you see his walking become increasingly aggressive. And then he just punches a hole in the automated realtor, which you kind of wanted to happen the whole scene. It's shocking to have moments like that that work so well, compact as this movie is, and how shorthand a lot of the character development kind of stuff is.
Like, you can see it in some of the reviews of the time, where even in the text of the reviews, not just reading into the way that it seems like a given critic was responding to something, some of them, in working out, did I see what I thought I saw? Because it was such an uncommon melding of different things and types that was incredibly uncommon then and is more common now, or at least, I mean, even in Marvel movies, there is expected to be, you know, some criticism of the military industrial complex and, like, coded social allegory and everything in a thing that's about superheroes flying in the air and punching aliens in the face.
But also humor and compassion.
Yeah.
You know, very, very important parts of Marvel movies, which, you know, may not, this kind of, again, kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily set the template. There probably were movies before that did it, but this was the most successful movie, I think, at the time, that had tried to bring all of those things into it. And I was just going to say the real climax of that pathos that you mentioned, Steve, is actually, I think, when after he takes off his helmet and he asks Lewis about what happened to his wife and kid. And she's like, oh, you know, they thought you were dead and they moved away. And he says, I can feel them, but I can't remember them.
But I can't remember them. Oh, that's a great line.
That is
shattering.
Oh, man. So good. So good.
I love that from that point on, he's got the helmet off too. I mean, it's been shattered at that point in what is another great, probably Verhoeven decision, where he's in the ED-209 fight and absolutely getting his ass kicked.
Yes.
And he's at his most vulnerable. And at that moment, his visor breaks and we get a close up shot of his human eye looking out for the first time. Yeah. So smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, we've already gone a bit long, so let's bring this to a close. But again, I just want to emphasize to everybody, if somehow you've been listening to this post-spoiler horn and you still haven't seen RoboCop, you really, really should. We've spoiled a lot of things. It won't spoil your enjoyment of the film. I think all of us here have seen it multiple times. I know, God knows, I have probably watched RoboCop 20 times. And it, you know, knowing what's going to happen does not spoil your enjoyment of the film whatsoever. It's so
still
well made. Yeah,
I have not seen it that many times, and I have regrets. I'm going to blame RoboCop 2 for that one.
I made mention of it having like a billion special edition home video releases, and as the physical media nerd, I think I hold the physical media nerd title or officer responsibilities on the mothership. There is a magnificent in the U.S. and I think the UK, Arrow Video special edition of RoboCop that has the unrated director's cut, the theatrical cut, loads of extras that have been around for a while, as well as newly produced stuff. We talked about this as a great film. I will stand by that, which I don't think is a terribly controversial opinion to have on this network or with this audience. But it was one of the releases in the Criterion Collection Laserdisc and DVD line that surprised people, where it was like, Jackie Chan and Supercop? What do you mean? You know, why are these among the most influential and interesting films? And it's because of what this movie does with the form that there is that level of scholarly academic, and I don't mean those as slights or hyperbole, kind of thought that has been given to what this movie did, and unfortunately its sequels then squandered all of that cultural currency. It is definitely worth seeing in the most beautiful, most immaculate way that you can. I think it's 4K on iTunes now too. But the 4K HDR remaster of it, it is one of those reference quality best ones out there that, since it is not hard to find, as in the early days of home video, it was difficult to see the unrated director's cut of it in the States. You could get the R-rated cut, but you had to, you know, buy an expensive Laserdisc and have a Laserdisc player to be able to watch it uncut. I love how much more accessible this movie is now, along with all of the really cool contextual supplemental stuff that goes with it.
Yeah, and it should be accessed again. You know,
yeah.
We implore you to go out and watch it if you haven't before, or to rewatch it if you haven't seen it in a while, because yeah, it's worth rewatching.
Steve having willed RoboCop 2 on himself so much makes me kind of want to petition Jason to let us do a RoboCop 2 and 3 like double feature rocket surgery.
It might be bad enough to meet those.
Count me out of that one.
just to get it out of it, just help it help purge it from Steve's system. I
will say, if RoboCop 2 was completely on its own as a standalone film and did not have the legacy of RoboCop to support, it wouldn't be that bad. But
I guess that's true. That's how I feel about Alien 3. Yeah.
As a follow-on to the original, now that I've got the proper perspective, having sort of let everything drain out of my brain for 20-odd years and watched them in the proper order, it's a slap in the face, really, to the legacy of the first movie.
RoboCop 2 would be so great if it were called Robot Cop.
It's
Return.
The second movie. It's directed by Irvin Kershner. It's got to be great, right?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, so I think that is a good place for us to end things. RoboCop, it's a great film. You should all go and watch it. As I say, for some insane reason you haven't already. And it just remains for me to thank our panelists today. Erica, thank you for joining us.
Please log off Zoom now. You have 20 seconds to comply.
Uh-oh. Hey. Moises, thank you for being here.
Directive 1, serve the public trust. Directive 2, protect the innocent. Directive 3, uphold the law. Directive 4, make sure the podcast is shorter than the object that is being discussed.
Yeah, we failed on that
Too late.
Oh, thank God there's only 4 directives.
Yeah, good thing is we fired a guy so we can shoot someone and throw him out the window.
And Steve, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Anthony. It's my pleasure. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go. Somewhere there is a crime happening.
And you have to commit it.
And thanks to you all out there for listening. Remember to come quietly, or there will be trouble. And we'll see you next time.